Good evening, and welcome to Dickinson College. My name is Allie Youngst, and I am a senior at Boiling Springs High School. I am currently participating in the Clark Forum Mentoring Program. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Anthropology and Sociology departments, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Sex, Race, and Class. During the past several decades, women have made considerable advancements toward achieving equality with men. However, there still remains the seemingly overwhelming economic hindrance. Women are still paid less than men for the same jobs, and they are also expected to raise children and fulfill domestic responsibilities with little or no acknowledgement of their efforts. In spite of the tremendously important task women have in rearing the next generation of workers, is it unreasonable to expect that they be paid for the housework and caring that they perform outside the market? Tonight's speaker, Selma James, has played a crucial role in the struggle for women's economic equality with men. James is currently the international coordinator of the Global Women's Strike, an organization that demands wages for all housework, clean and safe water and housing, and the abolition of third world debt. Her first pamphlet, A Woman's Place, led Selma James to found the International Wages for Housework campaign in 1972. Widely known for opening the domestic labor debate, James argues that the housework and care women perform outside the market support and sustain the workers. Since 1972, James has published many works on this and related topics, including Sex, Race, and Class, Women, the Unions, and Work, Strangers and Sisters, Women, Race, and Immigration, as well as Women's Unwaged Work, the Heart of the Informal Sectors. At this time, I would like to ask that you disable all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Ms. Selma James.
This is the mic. Okay. Thank you very much for a very generous introduction, but even more for a very generous welcome this evening. I met with people who had invited me, and Phoebe, my trusty companion, who does a lot of work to make sure that I'm up to getting up and speaking, and who's going everywhere with me on this whirlwind tour. I met the people who had invited us, and I was very gratified by not only their welcome, but their interest in much the same things that I'm interested in, and that Phoebe is too. And making me feel that what I say they were going to consider tonight in a serious way in relation to what they want to do in the areas where they operate. The tour was taken up this time. We decided to do it because we wanted to meet people in the movement for change, which is rearing its head, I'm happy to say, once again. And this is the first talk in that tour, and I must say, it tells me that the world has changed even more than I knew. I'm very happy to be here. Now, I wanted to tell you about why I wrote Sex, Race, and Class, that little pamphlet, which provided the title for this evening's talk. It was written in 1972, and in that year, we had already the experience of the 60s. I don't know what you know about the 60s. I suspect that most of the people here had not been born yet. But don't wait too long before you find out. a lot of important things happened then, which you are destined to build on. So get the firmest foundation that you can by informing yourself. I want to give you some idea tonight of what that remarkable period was about. In that time, in the 60s, various sectors of the population made themselves known. That is, they said who they were loud and publicly. They said what they wanted, what they had had enough of, what changes they wanted to see. First of all, it was in this country, black people in the United States. They signaled the change sometimes by burning the city down. That was a very dramatic entrance into history. But people had had enough, and they said so. In other parts of the world, third world countries had formed great movements for independence from the British or French or the other empires. And that was an important lesson to be learnt from people who thought that, for example, Africa was destined to be a colony forever and ever. And then there were women. It's the women's movement that I'm most familiar with. I saw it in Britain, and later I saw it in the United States. Women said they did not want to be subordinate any longer. They said they didn't like the fact that we didn't have pay equity, and we're still raising the question. They wanted childcare. They wanted jobs that interested them and that had some reflection of what they thought their talents were. There were lesbian and gay people who made their presence felt. There were people with disabilities who came together in organizations and demanded access. That is, they had the right to be part of the society, and because they had some physical disability, it didn't mean that they had to be sectioned off and not to participate fully in the society, that the disability was not their physical difficulty, but their social difficulty. It was society that was not making any way for them to participate. That was the problem. There were people who were mentally ill, who organized. I wonder if people know about that. It didn't happen a great deal in this country, although it happened somewhat. But I know that in Italy, people went into the institutions and discussed with the people there who had various forms of breakdown why it was that they were ill and what kind of lives they had lived that caused them to be mentally ill, and wouldn't they like to come on the anti-war demonstration? And a lot of them said, yes, that seems like a very good idea. And here they were marching down the street against the Vietnam War. They didn't look very disabled to us. There was the elderly, people who were older and formed the Grey Panthers there was in this country. But what was happening fundamentally was that people who had not been seen as social powers announced their presence. And if we look at who they were, we see that almost all of them were people who were not waged workers. Now, we were used to associating struggle with what the left calls the point of production. I don't agree on what the point of production is, but I'm ready to go along with it for the moment, because it describes people who were acknowledged as workers. They were acknowledged because the employers said they were workers. The employers even paid them at the end of the week, at least for some of their work, sometimes very low wages, always exploited work, but nevertheless, they worked. The rest of us didn't work. Now, what did we do instead? We worked. and we worked very hard. And we often worked all the hours that there were, but we were not acknowledged as workers. And although that didn't always come out in our movements, what came out was that there was an array of movements of unwaged people, students. Some of the students began to say, this business of studying is a lot of work. And a few of them said, and we should get paid for it. Now, those movements developed, taught each other many of the things that all of us need to know. And two things are particularly striking about them, aside from the fact that they tore up all old definitions of who people are and what they do and what they could do and what they must do and what they refuse to do. Two things. First of all, people came together on the basis of their social identity, so that you had professional women and women on assembly lines and housewives and welfare mothers, all different sectors of women coming together as women in the sense that they identified as women. And therefore, each sector of women was a power for the others. So there was a great coming together, apparently anyway. On the other hand, there was a great division. Because if you were a woman, many women thought, you had nothing to do with men. That is, sectors which had been dominant got short shrift from those from below who made their power felt. So there was a great dividing at the same time as there was coming together. The world changed forever during that period, but some things stay the same. In 1979 and 80, a great counter-revolution came to fruition. We had been struggling for some years against the war, against poverty, against exploitation of every sort, against discrimination, against racism, against sexism. But by 1979 or 80, it seemed as though the movements had exhausted themselves. Now, I want to discuss this a bit because we have to know, when we don't move straight ahead, what has held us back or thrown us back so that we can fortify ourselves for it not to repeat itself. In the movements that began in the 60s, two important things happened. First of all, the hierarchy shook in the sense that there had been an order in society, and I'll give you an example of how that can be measured. The wage hierarchy in the society was white men, white women, black men, black women, and immigrants, women and men, below that. Now you can say there's not a hierarchy, and in the West Indies you can say all of we is one, but the fact is there was a wage hierarchy. And that wage hierarchy reflected, in fact, a social hierarchy in general in the society that we were all arguing and fighting against without really acknowledging the totality of it. So that people in the movements who were ambitious, who when the hierarchy shook, felt that this was their chance to get ahead of whom? Get ahead of everybody. Those people could say that they were against that sector of the hierarchy that was standing on their heads without being against the hierarchy itself. I want to just repeat that. If you were a woman in the 1960s or 70s, and this has remained, you could feel, this is my chance to get out of it all. I'm not going to be somebody's slave at home. I'm going to have a career. I don't care how I get there. And I definitely don't want men in my way. And you know what? They didn't want women in their way either. There was a great flowering, unfortunately, of ambition and self-interest. And they could be self-interested and be ambitious among women, among black people, among black women, among lesbian and gay people, among disability activists. In every single sector, this was being repeated. They could be ambitious because they could claim that their movement ahead was of benefit to their sector. But of course, it wasn't. And it was part of what defeated the movement. Now, I saw this competition between sectors in the 1960s and in the beginning of the 70s. And then I wrote Sex, Race, and Class to respond to it. I want to read something from it, which is my trying to put the hierarchy together so that we saw it as one piece. So we saw our connections with each other. Now, I want to make it clear. I am not suggesting and was not suggesting then that to put the hierarchy together, that is to see all of us in an international hierarchy, is not for the purpose of hiding anything specific at any moment of the hierarchy. Because I remember the left at that time said we had to unite. I wanted to know who was uniting with whom. Were they uniting with us, or were we supposed to drop what we were doing as women and unite with them? And the latter was definitely not what we were in for. So it's not that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that we are all part of a hierarchy, and that hierarchy is exactly what makes capitalist society, what makes the society up, what keeps the society functioning so that one level of the hierarchy presses down on the other and we are in competition with each other, and the powers that be continue to be the powers that be. The light here is not excellent. Okay, I found a quote in Marx's Capital which expressed for me what I was trying to find my way to, and so I quoted it. I didn't say this. I'm not smart enough, but I was smart enough to know when a smart guy had said it. Manufacture, he's speaking about pre-industrial, but not the industry as we know it. Manufacture was before machinefacture. That is, people were still working by hand, but they were working collectively so that one fed into the next. He says, manufacture develops a hierarchy of labor powers. That is, a hierarchy among the people who have the power to work, to which there corresponds a scale of wages. That is, everybody in that hierarchy has another wage. Just what I had found about women and men and black people and white people, etc. If on the one hand, the individual laborers are appropriated and annexed for life by limited functions, that is, you do one thing all the time, that is factory work. A lot of it has left the United States, but people all over the world are now in factories, which do the work that we used to do here. It's repetitive, well, call center. It's repetitive. It doesn't develop your character, your personality, your interests, your creativity, nothing. It develops profit for somebody else. Go on. If on one hand the individual labor is appropriate and annexed for life by a limited function, on the other hand, the various operations of the hierarchy are parceled out among the laborers according to both their natural and their acquired capabilities. I always think of the children in India who make carpets, who are really enslaved by carpet making because they have small fingers, and therefore their layer of the hierarchy, their level, is low but crucial to the rest of what is going on. Now, from this, I made a comparison with today. And this is me, different from Marx, hoping to learn from him. A hierarchy of labor powers and a scale of wages to correspond. Racism and sexism training us to develop and acquire certain capabilities at the expense of all others. That is, when you're doing this, there are a whole set of things that you are not doing that you would prefer to. Then these acquired capabilities are taken to be our nature and fix our functions for life. And fix also the quality of our mutual relations. That is, when we do this work to earn our living, a whole set of relationships among the other workers in our family and elsewhere are shaped by the life that we are living and the work that we are doing. So planting cane or tea is not a job for white people. And changing diapers is not a job for men. And beating children is not violence. Race, sex, age, nation, each an indispensable element of the international division of labor. And then I speak about the fact that at the bottom of that hierarchy, to which there corresponds no wage, is the housewife. Now that's how I put it then. And I watched from that vantage point what happened to that hierarchy as it began to disintegrate, because the ambition of those sectors in every sector, which was ready to apply itself to any money that Reagan or Thatcher and their like and their establishment was able to give, they created NGOs and other organizations which acted not for us, but for them. But because they had come from these sectors, because they had the identity of the people who had made the movement, they were women, they were black women, they were black men, they were real working class, they were lesbian, they were gay, they had disabilities, they were prostitute women originally, whatever. Because they had come from these sectors, they had the credibility of having been one of us. And it was very difficult to attack them for what they were doing, perhaps selling us out, because they complained if you did that you were attacking the movement. Now, I have a lot of experience of this. I am not speaking academically. When you were confronted with those from your own sector who were working for the other side against the movement, which they often had been very active in building, then you were in a lot of trouble. I want to speak about two sectors in particular in relation to this. First, women. Phoebe is here and Dean is here, both from the Global Women's Strike, and they will tell you more precisely what their experience has been with the welfare movement. But I want to say a few things from my experience. The welfare movement in the 60s, until it was defeated in the 70s, was a great anti-racist women's movement. I knew them in this country, and my colleagues here also knew them and worked with them. They were women who demanded that the American government not cheat them for being carers, that they had a right to the money for raising their children, which the Vietnam War had been sucking the country dry for. Martin Luther King spoke about how the war, he has a brilliant speech about how the war was sucking like a great vacuum tube, sucking the country dry. And here were women on picket lines demanding that their children had a right to clothing, to be fed, etc., and not to be deprived of what this very wealthy nation had to offer, but only for war. I want to show you a picture. Now, you're not going to be able to see it. I'm going to describe it, but after the talk, you can come up and look at it. This is a book called The Politics of a Guaranteed Income by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, now dead, but he was a senator, and he was not a stupid man. He was very clever, and he knew a number of things, including, as he says in this book, if the women's movement, he says if the women's movement, 1973, really acknowledged women's work as being productive, women's housework as being productive, there would be no such thing as welfare because women would have the money and they would fight for it. Good point. This is a chart, and I'll tell you what's on it. It shows, it's called, it's talked about non-white males. Well, what can you do? Unemployment rate of non-white males. This is about the black population and attacking the black population. And it shows how when unemployment was high for black men, there would also be a rise in the welfare that black women were asking for, were applying for. So one goes up and the other goes up behind it, and they reflect each other until 1964. Okay, 1964, black men's unemployment goes way down, and black women's demand for welfare goes way up. This is a picture of a social movement in this country. It tells you that black women had a women's movement before the advent of feminism. I don't know the connection between the two. That's for you to say or to discover. How much the movement in this country of women forming their own organizations had to do, middle-class women, had to do with what grassroots women here were doing. But it's important for you to know that Dan Pat Moynihan understood very well what perhaps feminism did not. When, for various reasons, that movement began to disintegrate, as other movements did at more or less the same time. Then a variety of presidents talked about welfare reform. That is, welfare destruction. They reformed it out of existence. I must say that Michael Moore, in a recent film, did a wonderful job of portraying the result of welfare reform for a particular family, the mother traveling miles to go to work because that's the only job that she could get, and this her six-year-old son left to his own devices using a gun that he found somewhere and shooting someone. Not meaning any harm to anybody, but just a misguided six-year-old. Six-year-olds are not supposed to be left alone, you know, not even if they're black. When the struggle for welfare reform, or pardon me, against welfare reform was advanced, feminism on the whole was getting jobs. That is, they were forming or part of agencies giving women employment chances so they could get off welfare. And those of us who were struggling, along with welfare mothers, to get the money did not get the help from other women, did not get much help at all. That is an experience that we have to note, because here was a sector where the middle class and the grassroots, where the professional and the so-called working woman and housewife could be together to undermine sexism and racism for women and for men. But they divided along class lines so that some got jobs and some went to the wall. I want to give the other example, quite a different one, which is what happened to a man called Fred Hampton. Does anybody here know that name? He was 21 and he was a Panther. And the Black Panthers did a lot of very good work. I don't know that they did only good work, but I know they fed a lot of children. They helped a lot of people. And what Fred Hampton did was to organize not only among Black people, but among Puerto Rican people. And he began to work with gangs in Chicago and bring them into the movement for political change and away from the movement of mutual destruction. He was shot dead when he was 21 by, COINTELPRO? It's some program that the FBI had. We didn't hear a lot about him, but he, like many others, after the movement went down, continued to work as best they could to bring people together, not so they could forget their own case, but so that they could work with other people. Now, I want to give one final example, and not from this country. In the 1960s, a number of third world countries got their independence. I was involved in the struggle in the West Indies for independence and for federation, and they got the independence, but they didn't get the federation, which would have helped them to be far more independent than they ultimately wound up. One of the most remarkable people of the 20th century was a man called Julius Nyerere, and I hope you will find out more about him. He was the prime minister and then the president of Tanzania. And he wanted the country to develop, but he didn't want it to become just an arena for sweatshops. He wanted people to really have a chance to break away from, or rather not to go through, that period of industrialization which had been so destructive in every country where it had descended. And he said that there was a way in which African people worked together communally and took care of each other in the community that maybe we could build on and develop in a more harmonious way, and it would also be a chance to break from the barriers for women and for women to get more equality by being part of what he called Ujamaa villages, that is, socialist villages, that is, villages which work together collectively and collectively raise their productivity so that they would raise themselves out of poverty and develop in a slow but steady way. And he wrote something called the Arusha Declaration in February 5th, 1967. It was ushered in. And he said some extraordinary things about women, which I haven't seen taken up and which I have never heard from any head of state, of anybody in authority, in fact. He said, I must go with this light, I'm sorry. He says, on the financial, he's talking now about making analysis of third world society. Now that has to be of interest to us for one very important reason. Most of the world lives in third world countries. Almost everybody in the world works on wage. The number of people who work for wages in the world is a minority, a small minority. And so in order to live in the world and find out what's happening in the world and find out where you belong in the world, how you fit into the world, you young people are only coming to maturity now. You have to find out what's happening, not only outside of the United States. I approve entirely of that. This is a very provincial country. But you must find out what's happening in the non-industrial nine-tenths of the world. And President Nyerere said these remarkable things. I know the quote is long. You have to be patient with me. I have no way to do this in shorthand. Our emphasis on money and industries has made us concentrate on urban development. We recognize that we do not have enough money to bring the kind of development to each village which would benefit everybody. We also know that we cannot establish an industry in each village and through this means affect a rise in the real incomes of the people. For these reasons, we spend most of our money in the urban areas, and our industries are established in the towns. Yet the greater part of this money that we spend in the towns comes from loans. The foreign currency we shall use to pay back the loans used in the development of the urban areas will not come from the towns or the industries. Where then shall we get it from? We shall get it from the villages and from agriculture. What does this mean? It means that the people who benefit directly from development, which is brought about by borrowed money, are not the ones who will repay the loans. The largest proportion of the loans will be spent in or for the urban areas, but the largest proportion of the repayment will be made through the efforts of the farmers. Now, that's the first part of the quote. Now, can I just draw a couple of conclusions here? Not too many people in the world speak about the lowest in the population. And I don't hear, you know, presidents and prime ministers discussing the lowest paid, you know, as their priority. He is noting, and not only that, underlining that the people in the villages, who are the despised in the world, let's face it, that they're the ones who pay for that development which is in the city in third world countries. That is unusual, it's unusually frank and forthright, and politicians don't behave in this way. This is unique. Part one. Now part two. This is on how much women in the villages work as compared to men in the villages and waged workers in the city. He says, in towns, for example, wage earners normally work for 7.5 or 8 hours a day and for 6 or 6.5 days a week. This is about 45 hours a week for the whole year, except for 2 or 3 weeks leave. In other words, a wage earner works for 45 hours a week for 48 or 50 weeks a year. It would be appropriate to ask our farmers, especially the men, how many hours a week and how many weeks a year they work. Many do not even work for half as many hours as the wage earner does. The truth is, and it is the truth, that in the villages, the women work very hard. At times, they work for 12 or 14 hours a day. They even work on Sundays and public holidays. Women who live in the villages work harder than anybody else in Tanzania. But the men who live in villages, and some of the women in the towns, not too many, are on leave for half their life. Well, I never heard a head of state tell me about my work like that. This is unusual. But he goes on, part three. He says that if the men began to do the work that they should do, they would not need foreign loans. Now I want to draw a conclusion about what he's saying and point to a weakness of the women's movement. You know, when women are ambitious, or men, what they do is narrow their case so they don't make too much of a splash in their opposition. They make a small opposition, and they're very loud with it, so it sounds like they're making a lot of opposition. But he's saying that we have a big opposition to make. He's saying that we, women in the world, at least in Tanzania, and I do assure you this is true in Africa and in varying degrees almost everywhere else in the world, that the whole society is based on women's work, with one exception, children. Children work very hard in third world societies, and I suspect they're working harder and harder in this country in order to make ends meet when the family just can't get on with 2 or 3 or even 4 jobs. So that what President Nyerere was telling us, but that we women were not paying attention to, because it was coming from an African, that was part of the problem, but also we were self-engrossed in industrial countries and not thinking about what women in third world countries were going through or what their leadership was or was not doing. We have to change that. We have to be different about that. We have to open our minds to the whole world. What he was telling us was that we are not peripheral to the society, but central. Peripheral to the economy? No. Central. You're going to want this back, I know that. Okay. Now, on the basis of these experiences, I think I like speaking over there better. If you don't mind, I'll join you. On the basis of these experiences, we in the International Wages for Housework campaign made some decisions about what we were going to do. First of all, and always, we organize internationally. By the way, I don't want to do, this is not an advertisement for this campaign. I have no way of presenting another view except the one that we have lived through. It may not be wonderful, but it's the one I know best and the one we can judge and decide what we want to do if we want to organize for change. The first thing we did was to organize internationally. You'll see on our websites we have 20 or something languages there. We have as many languages as we can find translators who do it for free. You know, because we feel that the only way that we can continue to think internationally and accountably is to try to get other people to be involved with us because their presence in our network by its very existence is a demand for accountability from us and provoking us to be accountable to them. We have said, precisely because we are women, that we value caring. That's the work that we do. If even it is not the work that we are not mothers and we don't have elderly parents to take it, we don't do that caring, we are nevertheless identified that by that work because the rest of us are doing it. You know, there's no way, in a way, there's no way to escape the identity by merely leaving women's work behind. I don't know how you leave women's work. I've never been able to do it myself, but I try. But you somehow you find, you know, I remember making a film with the BBC, and it was about women's work, and the producer was a woman. And she said, you know, you think you, I don't know what you're talking about, but let me tell you, I am the producer, which meant the director in the BBC context. I am the producer of the film. If anybody in the crew has a headache, they come to me for aspirin. If they have a cold, they come to me for Kleenex. And I always say, I am the producer, I am not your wife or mother. But she, who had achieved something to be a producer for the BBC, nevertheless was not able, not even she, able to escape that identity. So that we, in order to be accountable on the one hand, build an international, on the other hand, we try to work together as women. And the basis of our working together is not to say there are no differences between us, but to stress, first of all, what we have in common, that is, caring work which is unwaged, and then discuss what is different about each situation. So we have a collective basis from which to deal with our differences, our disparities of power, based on whether we come from an industrial or a third world country, based on what our race is, based on what our age is, based on what our immigration status is, based on whether we're with men or not, based on whether we have a good job or a not so good job. I don't know what a good job is, but there must be some. based on all of the differences among us, which amount to fundamentally to class differences, but we are united as a sector. We use the power of the unity of our sector at the same time, not hiding the power differentials among us. That's where our organizing is founded. And that's why we are able to work with men, and well with men. We work well with men. Men are based at our women's center, and nobody is allowed to take advantage, no woman is allowed to take advantage of any men in our network because she has a problem with her look. You know, there's a lot of that goes on. I'm going to give him a push because he pushes me around a little, period. No. We don't have that. Dean is smiling. He knows it's true. The point is that your class, and this is what it means, sex, race, and class, that your class allegiance is worked out in relation to your sector. You work with your sector, but always accountable to those of us with least. That's how it has to be. It doesn't mean that we blackmail each other. Some people call it white mail, I don't care. It doesn't mean that we take advantage of each other because we have committed ourselves to the bottom and going from the bottom up. It does mean that we are always accountable to each other, but that each sector must make its own independent case, which then the rest of us can incorporate it into our case. There's always a growing and developing understanding of our own position because we are listening intently and working intently against the exploitation and experience of other sectors. We can discuss further in the discussion period, in the question and answer period. Finally, I wanted to say one other thing. It gives me a chance tonight to finish a thought that I put in the pamphlets, Your Sex, Race, and Class, but by the end of the question I asked in the first page, but by the end I'd forgotten it, so it was never answered in the pamphlet. And that is that I said, maybe I can quote it. Locked within the contradiction between the discrete entity of sex or race and the totality of class is the greatest deterrent to working class power. That is, our being kept apart by sex or race or other discriminations is the greatest deterrent to working class power. And then I say, and at the same time, the creative energy to achieve that power. Now, I never said what I meant by the creative energy. We lose a lot of energy trying to keep our position. Each of us, I'm speaking individually here. We spend a lot of energy trying to keep our place in the hierarchy and not be knocked down. There's a constant struggle 24 hours a day among us. You go in the underground or in the bus or something. You watch people. They are very concerned. All of us are very concerned about where we are and whether we're going to fall or rise. I mean, let's face it, that's our life. That's how we live our lives. And they don't announce it on the television, ever. What I was trying to say here was, in the same way as being divided drains us of energy,
In that same way, coming together is an explosion of energy, is a tremendous burst of creativity, of ability, and of power. And you see that when a movement begins to rise. You see people catching fire. It's like they never lived before, like they have for the first time understood something that they needed to know and had wanted to know all their lives. And you don't see it in two people or four people or six people or some people in some room somewhere. You see it everywhere, always exploding. We're on the verge of that now. We have much to oppose us. We have all kinds of laws in this country, and they're really working hard to bring them in Britain as well, to repress us and to put our children in prison early and to make sure that we are disciplined at every moment in our lives. I lived through the 50s. I lived through the McCarthy period. I know what it felt like. I won't have it again. I can't manage it. And I hope that this generation also feels that it will reject it. But at the same time that this is happening, it is really happening because they know that something else is on the way and they want to try to stop it. Don't let them. Thank you.
My question is about the little pamphlet. The thing said that you worked on the campaign in Venezuela to get. The pamphlet said that you were working in Venezuela to get women there, like the who work in the homes, a stipend to live on. And I was wondering, because I did some research on that, and the first stipends to go out didn't reach what it was supposed to. And I was wondering if you knew anything else, like what's being done to, you know, change that, to make it actually work, or any other thoughts about that.
Well, I didn't know that. I know that money was being given out. I don't know what you mean that it didn't work.
Well, in my research, it didn't go out to the number of women who were supposed to receive it. And also, there has not been that much of any news media covering anything that's actually going on. And so it's kind of, even though we have
the news media where in this country?
Well, anywhere. I haven't been able to find anything about it. All I found was in Off Our Backs, there was a couple of small articles saying, well, this is going to happen. But since these stipends went out, there hasn't been that much. And I was wondering, well, just because we have Articles 87 and 88, does that mean that it's actually doing anything? Or if you could just speak to, you know, how you...
How I see that.
Yeah.
Yes. First of all, money did go out, and some of it did not. And the degree of corruption in Venezuela is quite horrendous because they have been taking oil out of the ground for 100 years. And if you know oil economies, you know the level of corruption is unbearable. Chavez himself has tried everything in relation to that. But the grassroots, I think, has worked very hard against that corruption and they have made other arrangements about how the money is to go out. The point is they have formed committees in the community to try to keep tabs on the money that's to come to housewives. It's been very difficult, but they have done quite a lot of work along that line. What has been striking has been that Article 88 has not been campaigned on as we had hoped, because there just has been too much to do. I think that has really been the problem. But they're not going to get it properly until they campaign. Because what has to happen, I mean, Chavez has made arrangements that money was to go to women, but that was not Article 88. That was the spirit of Article 88. Article 88 says that women's work acknowledges women's housework as productive and that women are entitled to Social Security for that contribution to the economy and to the society. You should familiarize yourself with that. It's an important breakthrough for women and for the society generally. But that has never been implemented in the legislature. And I think that it will not be unless women campaign for it. I just don't think it will happen. You see, Chavez can do only so much. And then the grassroots have to deal with the bureaucracy. There is no shortcut to that.
Hi, thank you so much for being here tonight. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to paid domestic housework, i.e. women who hire other women to work in their homes, and how that affects and works into your campaign.
Right. There are two organizations of domestic workers who are part of the Global Women's Strike. One of them is in Peru, and one of them is in Trinidad. And I know a lot about what the Peru people are doing because somebody just came back from there who spent some time there. They've had a lot of trouble establishing themselves. They had originally had a radio program once a day for an hour. They have various radio stations that you can buy time for. And they were able to do a lot of organizing, and they have got some help from feminists, but unfortunately not a great deal, because the feminists often have their servants themselves. But they have succeeded in forming a union, and for that union to be acknowledged, and in fact the person who went for the first anniversary of that union, which has proved very successful. They have their own center, and they put people up who are thrown out because they refuse the advances sometimes of the employer. And we've discovered that domestic work is the largest employer of women in Peru, which means that there's a great deal of potential power there. And they are growing by leaps and bounds. They have an extraordinary woman who is their point of reference. And Adelinda is just a miraculous organizer. They have help from a number of priests who have saved women, because a number of women are sold into domestic work as children on the promise by employers that they'll send the children to school. But of course the children never go to school. What they do is go to the kitchen, etc. So I don't know much. You mentioned over dinner that there was somebody did, was it, no, I don't think it was you, someone else, about organizing domestic workers in Brooklyn, New York, which I was very interested. Fury was the name of the organization, and I want to hear more about that. What Peru has been able to do has been to make a connection between housewives and themselves, and talk about the work and how small the wages are for domestic workers, because housewives get nothing and that that really is a big break on domestic workers who do it for others, domestic workers getting paid. I'm not sure if you had any specific questions. In Trinidad, the Domestic Workers Union, National Union of Domestic Employees, which spells NUD, also organizes with low-wage workers and have had a lot of success. Peru has had a lot of success in the courts, by the way. Women taking employers to court who, after 20 or 25 years, refuse to pay them certain wages or refuse to acknowledge children, which are the product of rape by these men. And they have really done extremely well. And they've got a very, now in Peru, a very good lawyer. The problem with so much of this is that you need devoted professionals to help, to work for you for little or for free, who will be dedicated to you getting justice. And that's been very hard to come by. And we found that also in Philadelphia and in other places where we have centers, to get a lawyer who will actually take you as their point of reference is sometimes very difficult. Not sometimes, almost always. Same thing with doctors. Women or men, it's very hard. Yes, you're the one who spoke about the domestic workers in Brooklyn. Yes.
So my question was more directed towards what lesson can you give us on the following. You mentioned the ambition and kind of self-esteem in the struggle and how that was a component that, you know, that individualization of a struggle at a moment kind of separated groups and kind of deviated the, you know, a united struggles in the 60s. I see that situation happening a lot right now, especially talking about students, right? I see a lot of that self-esteem and ambition towards, you know, what we can call a struggle, but it's more kind of an aesthetic ideal of what a struggle is. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on that and how you see, you know, the current situation of different struggles, specifically among young people and students.
First of all, I'm very impressed by the number of campuses who are fighting for proper pay for university employees and against sweatshops. It's very clear that students feel, or many students feel, that they must be accountable to the other people who work on that campus and who work for them fundamentally, and that's very encouraging. But there is very little clarity, I think, yet, and there must be more on what the NGOs and these special people who go up and forget they ever were down have been doing. We heard from a very exciting woman in Iraq, a grassroots woman who is organizing with women, mainly for survival under those horrendous circumstances. And she told us a couple of things which rather blew us away about NGOs. She said when the Americans arrived, they came with over 140 women's NGOs. That was part of their entourage. And I think that tells you a lot about what NGOs are doing in the world. Fundamentally, the first thing that I think we have to do is discuss it. I don't think there has been a discussion about it. I don't think we have defined when going for a career means going to push other people down in order to move up. And when it means that if I go up, everybody goes up with me. I'm not suggesting that people should not rise in the hierarchy. I just hope they don't rise alone. And I do hope that once they get there, they are accountable to what they have left behind. That's really the question. And I don't think this has been offered. I think that people, young people, have been encouraged to think of their own careers and their own advancement and not to think of their society. You know, when Margaret Thatcher came in, I don't know how much you know about her, but she said that there is no such thing as society. And by which she meant there's only her, fundamentally. Well, she meant think of yourself. Nobody else will. I won't for a start. I mean, that this is where she was at. This is what we have been trained. You know, how we have been trained to think and how we have been trained to relate. And I think the first thing to do is to look at it and to see what the NGOs are doing. You know, a woman came to our center to a strike meeting, and she said she was from WaterAid, I think was the name. And she really didn't know a lot about us because she sat there and told us how the best thing that could happen in Africa was for the water to be privatized. Now, I don't know if you know what that means, but that means that people will go without water because they haven't got the money to buy it. And what was she doing there? I mean, why did she think she knew what should happen in Africa? She was 24. You know, the arrogance and presumption of people who have power over others must be seen to be believed and must be believed. You know, we have to know that this is an important part of our life. You know, when they went into Iraq, they said that they wanted the journalists to be embedded. I thought that was a really excellent way to put it. They were in bed with the U.S. Army, and they wanted everybody else. And these others that I'm describing, they are embedded, you know. And they have to be disembedded or defeated. But you have to acknowledge that this is an important part of the structure of your society by now. You know, it is written into the way that we relate, and it is part of the description of the enemy. So that's where to begin, I think. And I think that you all are in a really very good place to do that, because the Clark Forum is obviously a bit extraordinary. I mean, I hope that there are many, but I haven't heard about them. And you are having a dialogue, and this is something to have a dialogue about and do research about and Google and things like that.
A very quick question. You described the corruption in Venezuela as being horrendous.
Horrendous.
How would you describe the corruption in the United States?
I have no description. It's beyond me. It is really beyond me.
Monumental.
Pardon?
Monumental.
Monumental, that's a good one. I don't know if you saw Syriana. Did people see that film, Syriana? Do you remember that moment in time when he complains about corruption? And this guy says, corruption? Corruption is why we win. And I thought, my God, they're having more and more truths out of Hollywood. They win by corruption. And then they blame the people they corrupt for being corrupt. That's what they do. They say Africa is corrupt. Who is corrupting them? We don't know who's corrupted. This is self-induced corruption. It's quite an extraordinary thing. And it's very terrifying if you're in Venezuela, if you live there, I don't, if you live in Venezuela and you know that the American government is at every moment considering should they invade or shouldn't they invade and what are the pros and what are the cons, and these people are quite crazy up there and you don't know what they're thinking. And then you know that people in your society can be bought and therefore can act as agents for what the American state may want to do. So it is a very serious question. But I'm glad you asked what you did, because I understand that you know that it is not a third world ailment only, but that there's a lot of it about. I think people have asked their questions. No, one more.
I have a question. I know how I answer when people ask me this, but I'm curious to see how you answer. When people have said to me, why would women want to organize for wages for housework? Because that simply identifies women more with this form of labor that has worked to undervalue the lives and work of women. So that we would want to divide ourselves from wages for housework instead of organizing for it. We would want to figure out a way to either eliminate that work through mechanization, which has been a long dream, right, or to get men to share in that work, share equitably in that work.
Well, first of all, I don't think that we eliminate work by hiding it. I think we're stuck with it until we spell it out, spit it out, make it clear that it's going on. I think the very act of saying that we do this work is an attack on our having to do it, at least on our having to be the only ones who are doing it, by which I mean this. One of the great defeats that we have suffered as women and as a society is that the caring work that we have done has been demeaned, and that we are given the option, apparently the only option, that the only way not to be enslaved by caring is not to do it. So our children are not cared for, or would not be if we didn't care for them. And it's as though that doesn't matter. It matters greatly. My own view is that most of the work of society can be eliminated, because the junk that's manufactured, we would lose nothing by it not being manufactured. But one thing that we should continue to do and increasingly do is precisely caring work. That's what we want to do instead. Caring need not be a slavery. It is a slavery if only women do it, number one, and if it's a duty rather than freely given and part of a developing relationship. Now, I know people who do caring work in homes for the elderly, in places where people are ill, who are dedicated to that work, who love the people they care for, who get a great deal out of it. They're usually older people themselves, older women, who need not go to work, who have their pension or whatever. That is, they have an income and they're not driven to work every morning. And they are enamored of their work. They think they're spending their lives in the most productive and delightful way, because they're helping other people, having relationship with other people, learning about other human beings, and part of a community. We mostly don't feel that with the caring work. We feel it's an obligation and something that we're forced to do. But when we demand money for it, we first of all say it's important. It's socially necessary. It's what the society must have. And it's for me to get the respect and recognition for doing this important work. You know, one woman, a journalist, who I had a long battle with her, she came to the house to argue with me on the subject. And we spent some hours arguing, and then she thought she finally got it, and she wrote a most magnificent article, which I must really resurrect. This was really a lot of years ago, and she's since died. And her name was Jill Tweedy. You probably don't know her here. And she said, "My slave hand doesn't say what my free hand. My free hand doesn't say what my slave hand is doing." What she was saying is that although she's a journalist and living her life in the world, at the same time, she is embedded, yes, the word applies here, embedded in a form of slavery which she hides not only from the society but from herself. And that's what wages for housework undermines. It puts it right out there. And it says that the state, if it is to do anything right, must acknowledge this basic work of making the human race. And I really think that demeaning, this is my considered view, okay, that demeaning caring work is a way of, not acknowledge, that's not what I want, a way of justifying war. I think so, and I'll tell you what the connection is. That if you do not think that human beings are worth caring for, then it really doesn't matter if you kill them. There's a deep connection between the two. And to the degree that we make this society acknowledge that the care of human beings, it makes us human, for God's sake. To the degree that we force that acknowledgement in whatever way we can, beginning with the demand for money, because people understand that, to that degree, we transform the priorities of the society and demand that caring is more important than killing. As a matter of fact, that killing really shouldn't be done at all, including, I might add, the death penalty. I think there is a connection. I think we have a power as women who are fundamentally the carers to drive this point home beyond anything else, that we as human beings are entitled to care from other human beings. Entitled. We have a right to it. We can't really live our lives without it. This is the truth. We can't. Any psychoanalyst will tell you that. You know, and they need more and more psychoanalysts as there's less and less care. So I think that's, you know, we may not love money, but we have to demand of the people who do love money that we get some for this important work. Okay.
Once again, I would like to thank Selma James for being with us tonight. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to present her with a token of our gratitude.
Oh, lovely. Thank you very much. You're welcome. Beautiful. Thank you.
This concludes our presentation. Thank you for coming.